It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Well, today it's one of my favorite books of the year and the ultimate party food, the Cinderella meatloaf, or making your own pate, with a little help from our guest, Michael Ruhlman. He's co-author of Charcuterie, The Craft of Salting, Smoking, and Curing. Well, the Sterns have found a place that's like going home to mom. Josh Wesson does fruitcake triage, the wines that can save the gâteau. Dory Greenspan brings a French twist to the cookie exchange. New York food guy Mike Colomeco talks holiday eating in the city. And then it's the kid who had to have a date for Christmas Eve and the comic strip it led to, The Feast of the Seven Fishes. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
A merry little Christmas. Let your heart be light. From now on, our troubles will be out of sight. A merry little Christmas. Make the Yuletide gay. From now on, our troubles will be miles away. That are dear to us, gather near to us once more. Through the years, we all will be together. If the fates allow. Shining star upon the highest bough, and have yourself a merry little Christmas now. Thank you.
merry little Christmas now. And have yourself a merry little Christmas.
It's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's party food par excellence. We're bringing home the pâté and the smoked salmon and even the bacon. Our guest is Michael Ruhlman, co-author of the first book embracing the art and the science of charcuterie. Now, it's all about the oldest and most delicious methods of preserving what we eat. The book is called Charcuterie, The Craft of Salting, Smoking, and Curing. Well, Josh Wesson helps out the much maligned fruitcake. He's got great wines to perk it up. Then it's where to go for a holiday meal in New York City. Pure romance and great food from New York food guy Mike Colomeco. We have the online comic strip and new book, Feast of the Seven Fishes, the story of a guy who dreams of having a girl for his Italian family's Christmas Eve. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Hey, Jane and Michael, it occurs to me that if you're traveling at this time of year, you really want to find a place that kind of feels like home. Got any suggestions?
Yeah, Becky's in Portland, Maine, and I have to say I enjoy it better than dining with my own family. but that's another show.
Yeah.
Becky is a one-woman dynamo, and she started, I guess it's you would call it a wharfside diner. It's very kind of working man, inexpensive food, everything made from scratch. But she has the biggest heart in the world. And this is the kind of restaurant where if you are a regular and you don't show up for a couple of days, Becky will call you or come to your house and make sure you're fine.
And there is a story of one customer who didn't show up for a couple of days. They called. He said, "I'm sorry, I had an operation. I'm home. I can't get out." And they brought him food for a week.
Oh, Lord.
She sounds like a gem. She is a gem, and she had a hard time because she was the mother of many children, and her husband, I believe, was a fisherman and walked down on her, and she was just kind of left with no money and all these kids to support. And it's kind of like the classic, you know, all-American dream where she found this little place and just worked so hard. I mean, literally told us that, like, at the end of the day from washing dishes, her knuckles were bleeding, and just made a tremendous success of it, but never left the kind of family customer-based spirit that it started with.
What kind of food does she do?
It's real Maine food in a not show-offy way. The best thing on the menu, if you happen to go there on a Friday, is the seafood chowder. This is absolutely sensational chowder. Kind of creamy, but not goopy at all. Rich with just big chunks of fish and some clams. It's just one of those great, heartwarming, soul-warming meals that you want any day of the week, but it's always there on Friday. The other thing that you want to eat at Becky's for sure is breakfast. It's just like so many diners. It's a place where breakfast stars. I mean, there's one thing they have called a Titanic omelet, which I like a whole lot. I don't have to explain. That has some of everything in it, and I think it's made with 6 eggs.
I think the food at Becky's is kind of designed for fishermen who love to have their breakfast there, but It's food is enormous. The omelets are enormous. When you order bacon with your omelet, you know, it seems like you get 10 slices of bacon.
A side of bacon.
You should be out lobstering all day.
Oh, and speaking of bacon, I just have to interject here. One of the items that you find on the breakfast menu as well as on the lunch menu is the bacon and peanut butter sandwich. Now, this is something to stick to your ribs, especially if you have it on the Italian bread that is so popular in Portland. She uses that kind of natural, real thick, chunky peanut butter, lots of bacon, and toasted, grilled Italian bread around it. This is a dish that Elvis would love, let me tell you.
She's really kind of a bacon fanatic. She told us she goes through 20 cases of bacon a week. And she has a secret, which is that she oven bakes the bacon on parchment. So it's crisp and the grease kind of falls, you know,
right
to the bottom of the parchment paper. But Becky's, you know, it's really a place where the whole gestalt of the place is what's so charming. Not just the food on the plate, which is very, very good, but, you know, it's just a warm hug. I mean, even, and nobody is a stranger there.
It sounds great. Guys, thank you.
You're welcome, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
Won't you be good to yourself? And don't you feel like coming home? It'll be cool. It'll be like coming home.
Gene and Michael Stern's Classic Guide Road Food has been updated. Now, you can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. You know where. Splendidtable.org. Oh, and while you're there, take a look at our upcoming trip. We are heading to Santa Fe. It's a combination of two of the finer things in life, food and music. Now, in August, we're headed to the high desert of Santa Fe. The trip includes tickets to the Santa Fe Opera and the Santa Fe Chamber Music Festival, and dinner and a market tour with me. So check out the website for more details. It feels like a very civilized trip. That's splendidtable.org. You know, Santa Fe turns one's thoughts to chilies. Now, in Santa Fe, the local gem is the Española Valley chili. It's really bright and hot, and it's often tough to find unless you know somebody who knows somebody. On the other hand, there's a chili from the Middle East that I am in love with, and it would be a good ingredient gift this year. Paula Wolfert introduced us to the Aleppo pepper in her book, The Cooking of the Eastern Mediterranean. Now, this is a chili. It's sweet. It's fairly hot. But the thing that sets it apart is it's wonderfully fruity. And this is the kind of gift cooks and non-cooks love, because all you have to do is sprinkle. I mean, fork some into a baked sweet potato. Stir it into takeout hummus. Now, I like it in chicken and egg salad, and I just found out that Aleppo pepper with olive oil and coarse salt turns steamed broccoli into ambrosia. Now, if you can't find it locally, we've got mail order sources up on the website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is the most democratic wine expert I know. Now, this is the celebrity sommelier turned bargain wine maven. Josh created bestsellers, wine shops, but the sommelier skills are still all there. Josh can pair almost any food with the right wine. So I figure he can help me out with my quest this week. Hey, Josh, welcome back.
Oh, I love being back.
Josh, I need you to do some fruitcake triage for me, because I like fruitcake. So what wine should I serve with fruitcake?
Well, there's no doubt that wine can be an antidote to fruitcake. It can help you get beyond your fear of fruitcake, but you don't have that fear, and you want me to triage, so I'll put on my little doctor's coat and talk about what I see when it comes to holiday fruitcakes. And basically, I send them into one of two tents. One is dark.
Right.
Where all the cakes are moist and they're sticky and they're rummy and they're chocolatey and they last forever. I mean, they have no expiration date.
Mm-hmm.
And there's certain kinds of wines that you want to have with those kinds of fruitcakes. And then there's the opposite, which is a fruitcake that's white or yellow, and it's got all sorts of candied fruit in it and sort of crumbles when you put it in your hand. And that stuff doesn't last forever. That's not what you want to put in the fallout shelter. But those light, crumbly fruitcakes should, you know, be served with certain kinds of wine that are very different from the dark fruitcakes.
Okay, so which wines then?
Well, if you're in, you know, the tent with the dark fruitcakes, you want to find dark wines, wines that mimic and flatter and repeat the flavors and textures that you find in these dark holiday fruitcakes. So I go for fortified wine, not surprising.
Right.
But I like things that aged tawny port, 10-year-old tawny ports being my sweet spot, literally and figuratively, for fruitcake wines that are dark. And I like Madeiras. And I also like, and I just because I happened to stumble across these at a tasting not too long ago, sweet dessert-style beer. I've been knocked out by cream stouts and creeks, lambic creeks from Belgium, or Belgian-style beers. And I even had one, a sweet dark beer that came from Japan, which absolutely blew my mind. Huh. I had it with chocolate cake, but I'm sure it would be stunning with fruitcake.
You know, just thinking that quality that beer has, the maltiness, that would be great with cake. It makes a great deal of sense.
And sometimes you get beers that are actually flavored with fruit. Creek, for example, is flavored with cherries, and it goes beautifully with preserved fruit in dark cakes. Some of my favorite, I had a Creek that came from Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, from the Bethlehem Brewery, and it goes for about $3 a bottle. And this Creek was just a knockout with dark cake. And I also had a Hitachino Nest beer from the Kiyuchi Brewery in Japan, which was equally good. I was doing a beer and dessert tasting, mm-hmm. and it was just, you know, mm-hmm. fabulous. But we talked about ports, and, you know, I've got to, you know, tip the hat to tawny ports. And my favorite modestly priced one right now, and modest, of course, is a relative term when it comes to tawny port, is by Graham's. Famous house.
Right.
And they make a 10-year-old tawny port for about $24, $25 a bottle. But it is just, you know, the universal antidote to dark fruitcake. It will cure all ills and make you a believer.
It's the time of year for splurges anyway. Okay, what about the other tent, the white fruitcake tent?
The white fruitcake. Well, there the dominant taste isn't the cake. It's really going to be the candied fruit that's in there. And with candied fruit, I found no better ally than fortified muscat. Muscat's a light grape. It's sort of a grape that pulls in the apricot dried fruit direction as opposed
mm-hmm.
to
yeah.
fortified wines that are made from red grapes like port and Madeira and sweet cherries. And, you know, the mother of all fortified muscats is from southern France. It's from Baume de Venise, and it's called a Muscat de Baume de Venise. And Jabalé makes a wonderful one. They have forever. And they make it in half bottles and full bottles, so you don't have to dive in for a full bottle if you think you only need a half. And their half bottles go for about $20, and, you know, they're stunning with that light cake.
Mm.
And if you'd want to spend even less than that and you get a half bottle of some sweet fortified muscat, look to Australia, where they call these wines stickies. And they really are stickies because they, you know, open the cork, they get all over your hands. And you can use them to wash off all the crumbs from the cake.
You just roll your finger in the cake.
Exactly.
That's a very good idea. Yeah.
And there's a wonderful one from R.L. Buller, B-U-L-L-E-R. And they make an entry-level muscat called Premium Fine Muscat. It's a non-vintage, and it goes for about $15 a half bottle. You can also spend $100 on their super-aged one, but you don't need to with fruitcake. Their $15 fine muscat is stunning and a wonderful companion to that lighter style of holiday dessert.
I'm going to do all these conversions now. I'm going to turn fruitcake haters into fruitcake lovers. Hey, Josh.
I'll be right with you.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Wine authority Joshua Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can find his fruitcake wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. And you might want to consider his book, Red Wine with Fish, as gift material. It's become something of a collector's item. Coming up, the Cinderella meatloaf and a French entry for the cookie exchange. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, home of Archer Farms, where you can find modern takes on old-time classics like angel food cake, quiche, and garlic bread. Find them online at Target.com/SuperTarget. There's a book that came out this year that I see as a groundbreaker. Now, its title could be its enemy. A lot of folks may not know what it means. The book is called Charcuterie, but the subtitle says it all. The craft of salting, smoking, and curing. Now, we're talking sausages and pâtés, even your own home-cured bacon and salami. Now, in Europe, charcuterie is high craft. It's done by masters. Here, it's the latest thing in the artisan food movement. But the important thing about this book is that it has recipes and the all-important science written for the home cook. Well, Charcuterie is co-authored by Michael Ruhlman. Michael, it's good to have you back.
Happy to be here.
Now, I think what you better do is explain what charcuterie actually means.
Americans know charcuterie as cold cuts, salami, bologna, ham. Charcuterie is prepared food. It used to be primarily pork, cooked pork products. But modern charcuterie has broadened to include all manner of food that's been cooked or preserved, everything from smoked salmon to duck confit to vegetable terrines to the exciting sauces and condiments that can go with them.
Now, where is the craft here? Because historically in Paris, for instance, there were guilds that or unions where, you know, they only did charcuterie.
And there were laws governing it. The craft is in a number of places. I love this style of food for its craft. One is seasoning. You have to have a very smart seasoning hand. This food is often served cold, so it has to be highly and effectively seasoned.
Mm-hmm.
Creating an emulsion. Many of these products use what's called an emulsion, which is a suspension of fat. The fat is distributed evenly throughout the whole product, whether it's a sausage or a pâté. You have to keep things cold so that the emulsion remains stable. Things like that, if you don't pay attention to that sort of craft issue, you're going to have a terrible product at the end.
What about the safety issue? Because I always get nervous when I see recipes where people say, here's how you make your salami and hang it where it's cool for whatever. And I'm thinking, this can be Ptomaine Gulch.
With dry cured sausages, there are significant safety issues. Dry cured sausages require some form of sodium nitrite or sodium nitrate, which is a naturally occurring chemical. It's found in spinaches and celery and other root vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
It's made into a salt that preserves the meat, keeps it rosy and pink, gives it a piquant flavor, and most importantly, it prevents botulism poisoning. That's
why it's
used. So you don't get nasty bacteria, which can form in the interior of the sausage. Otherwise, it's more or less common sense. If your sausage is moldy and rank, you don't eat it.
But I'd like to talk about what I think is the great entry-level food for people who want to get into charcuterie. And also, at this time of year, this is prime party food. You call it the Cinderella meatloaf, the pâté. Can you give us the basics of making a pâté?
A pâté is simple to make, and it is perfect party food. It can be done ahead of time. It can be done to your own taste. It's fun to make, it's fun to serve, and it's impressive to your guests. So the basics are to have first of all, pay attention to seasoning, which means plenty of salt. It's going to be served cold, mm-hmm. So it needs to be seasoned real high. And you're going to want salt and something like quatre épices, which is a mixture of black pepper, nutmeg, cinnamon, cloves.
That's four spices. That's how it translates, right?
That's four spices. You mix the meat, chunks of meat and
right. Fat,
and then you grind it all together. You grind it through a grinder, though I've got chef friends who actually cut it by hand. You can do that, too.
Can I use a food processor?
It helps to have a grinder because you're assured of getting all the meat uniformly ground. But certainly, this is rustic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then mixing or pureeing. So you can puree a ground mixture, or you can just mix it with a standing mixer with a paddle, just so it all coheres, so it distributes the fat, distributes the seasoning, so it's a uniform mixture. It looks like a meat paste. And then It's putting it in a terrine mold or some sort of mold, or you could even wrap it in plastic wrap into a roulade and cook it in a water bath till it reaches 150 degrees Fahrenheit.
And then you cool it,
and that's it. It's no more different than making a meatloaf, but you're just paying special attention to those few steps that I mentioned.
Is there a particular cut of pork, if you're making a pork pate, that we should use?
Absolutely. Another great part of charcuterie, it uses the cheapest cuts of meat available. Another craft issue also, you use the shoulder, also often called the Boston butt. This is an economical form of cooking, and I love forms of cooking in which you take the cheapest cuts you can get and you turn them with your craft into something really beautiful and special and fun to eat.
Now, does it have to be meat, by the way?
It doesn't have to be. You can make wonderful terrines out of grilled vegetables, for instance. That's a great terrine, vivid appearance and delicious to eat and very helpful and vegetarian if you're a vegetarian.
And you can do seafood too, right?
Seafood terrines are probably the easiest, in fact. You create what is called a mousseline, and that's basically egg whites, cream, and fish. And you puree that in a food processor, it results in an extraordinary and beautiful and delicate and wonderful pâté en terrine. It's what Escoffier said, in fact. The mousseline was the most stable forest meat of all. It's certainly the most home-friendly kind of pâté en terrine you can make.
Hey, Michael, thank you.
It's a delight to be here anytime.
Food writer Michael Ruhlman is co-author with charcuterie authority Brian Polson of Charcuterie, the craft of salting, smoking, and curing. Now, you can get their recipe for pâté de campagne, country pâté, on the website splendidtable.org. Food Authority Dori Greenspan is one of those consummate pros. She's co-authored books with Julia Child, Danielle Ballou, and French pastry deity Pierre Hermes. But my favorite book of Dori's is her very own, about the city she loves. Paris Sweets, great desserts from the city's best pastry shops. Dori, welcome.
Hi there.
You know, Dori, it's cookie exchange time again, and I'm thinking I want some French influence in my Christmas cookies this year, and I figure you're the woman to go to. So tell me about French cookies.
Well, you know, it's funny because when we think about French pastry, at least when I do, I rarely think about cookies. You think about French cakes or you think about French breakfast pastries, but France has fabulous cookies, just wonderful cookies. And there are two that I'm thinking about. Both of them are from André Lerch, who he's still a baker, but he no longer has a shop in Paris. He had a shop just in the shadow of Notre Dame, an adorable shop. He was an Alsatian pastry chef and baker. And the first cookie that I have from him is an anise cookie. Now, anise is, well, you know what it is. It's like a fennel seed. It has that kind of licorice-y flavor.
Right, right.
And these cookies, I think of them as magic buttons because it's a... Wait. I'll tell you what. Because there are these little cookies that are made with sugar and eggs and flour. There are no butter in the cookies. And you beat them up, and then put them out in little spoonfuls on a buttered and floured baking sheet. This is very important that the sheet be buttered and floured.
Right.
And what you have are just these little drops of cookie dough.
Uh-huh.
Then you leave them overnight, and what you have is still drops of cookie dough. But when you put them in the oven, this is the magic part. They rise so that they have a little craggy circle around the bottom, like a little foot, the way a macaroon gets a little craggy circle.
Oh, yeah.
And then the top turns white, almost as though you had put royal icing over them. I just think they're amazing, and they're very crunchy, and they're like biscotti in a way in terms of texture. And while I like anise as much as the next person, it's not my all-time favorite flavor to have all the time. And so what I do, the way you do the cookie is you put the anise and the sugar in a food processor so that you end up with anise sugar.
Right.
What I often do is put vanilla beans into the processor with the sugar.
It could be bad.
Right? Exactly. Forget the anise if you're not an anise lover.
Right.
And make these with vanilla beans. And they are so good. And they're so much fun. You just have to wait 24 hours for the fun.
But the other thing is there's no butter in them, it sounds like. And it does sound kind of magical.
I think it really is, and they keep forever. You can send them. They're great cookies to send because they're very, very packable. You just don't want to pack them with anything soft because the crunch will go.
Yeah, exactly.
But the other cookie that I think is super for Christmas is the sablé, which is really the French shortbread cookie. And it's made with confectioner sugar and butter so that it's a very tender, soft cookie. And what's so great about sablé is they have this fancy name, but essentially they're refrigerator slice and bake cookies. So you make the dough and you make it into logs, and then you just slice them the way you would store-bought dough cookies. But you can make these so festive for Christmas because you can just brush egg yolk over the logs and use any kind of decorating sugar on them or little sprinkles, and they are just adorable, and they're so good. They're so good. But the thing about sablé is you have to be very, very gentle with them so that when you beat the – they're butter cookies, so it's a cream the butter and sugar together. You don't want to cream the butter and sugar until it's all airy. You just want to get it so that it comes together. And then when you add the flour, you really want to be gentle. And I use a stand mixer, and I cover it with a towel when I add the flour. And so it's draped – here's my mixer, you know.
Why? To make it feel cozy? Is this the reason?
Well, actually, you know, I have a KitchenAid mixer that has these arms that cradle the bowl. So I always think of it as like a cozy mixer to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah,
no. I put the towel over it because what I like to do is pulse the machine on and off so that the flour gets mixed in as gently as possible and so that you're not overworking the dough. But, of course, the problem with pulsing is that the flour just flies all over. So the kitchen towel holds it in there. And you can do this if you're using a hand mixer, or of course you can do this by hand. And then when you shape the dough, shape it into logs, and then I keep in my spare cupboard I have the inner tubes from paper towels. And I just slit the tube down the center and wrap the cookie logs in plastic film and then put them in the cardboard tubes so that they will stay round in the refrigerator.
And you can put them in the freezer that way, too,
and you can
right?
put them in the freezer that way, and you never have that little flat spot on your cookies.
You are such a perfectionist, girl. I can't tell you. Hey, Dory, thank you.
It's been fun. Happy holidays.
You too. Dory Greenspan is author of Paris Sweets, Great Desserts from the City's Best Pastry Shops. Now, you can get Dory's recipes for the anise cookies and lemon sablés on the website, guys, splendidtable.org. Mike Colomeco is our go-to guy for what not to miss in New York City. Now, Mike's the former chef who knows the city scene from the inside out, whether it's hot dogs, hangouts, or the highest of the haute. Well, he covers the waterfront for his PBS 13 program, Mike Colomeco's Food Show. Hey, Mike, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks, Lynn. Always great to be here.
Could we talk holidays in New York City? I mean, Christmas in New York has got to be the most romantic notion I can think of.
it really is. It's a spectacular time of year. It always has been. But in terms of, you know, the culinary stuff, it's a bit of a conundrum. It's a great shopping time of year, that's for sure. All the windows are done up, you know, walking around town, spectacular. But really, a couple of suggestions, and one of them, against my better judgment as a culinarian, but I think just because the space is great, you have to mention Tavern on the Green. It's the only restaurant in Central Park. It's been there for years. I worked there many, many moons ago when Warner Leroy was the owner, and it's just spectacular for Christmas. They've got one of the greatest trees in every room that you've ever seen, 10,000 Christmas balls, 3,500 handmade ornaments. I think there's a million lights outside. You can see it from anywhere around town just looking down into the park, and the place just screams Christmas. The food's okay. I mean, you know, any place that does 2,000 covers on a Saturday night, you kind of go, all right, whatever. But the room is just, without a doubt, it's probably the most festive space in the city for that time.
Boy, that was always the best date place, too. You said something to me that just had me howl. When you worked there, they had a snowmaker?
On the roof or something?
Believe it or not, we had a crazy GM named Bruce Axler who wore, he had three blue suits. He might have had one, but big cigar in his mouth, and he was kind of like a nut. He was like the Patton of the food business. All worked 24 hours a day, it seems, 7 days a week, and he brought in these snow machines just like you'd see on East Coast ski slopes that you pump in water on one end, they make snow on the other, and no matter what the weather forecast was at Tavern on the Green, we had 5 inches of powder. And it was, these things were noisy. I think finally the co-ops across the street that, you know, were worth like $1 million a room, finally they got them to shut these things off years later. But it was a gas because you'd sit in the room. New York could be 42 and balmy, and you'd be in that dining room under the tree with snow flying all over the place, guys outside building snowmen, you know.
Pure theater.
Like a Tim Burton movie.
Pure theater. Okay, so where else would you want us to go?
Well, on a more serious, by far, culinary note, a great friend of mine's the chef, Ed Brown, at a place called Sea Grill, which is right in Rockefeller Center, adjacent to skating rink, which, as anybody knows that, you know, turns on the news or watches the newspaper, that's where they put the tree. Every year they bring the tree in, light it up right after Thanksgiving.
Right.
It's a spectacular tree. It's above the rink, right above that gold Prometheus, and it's just a wonderful room. It's a seafood restaurant. They have some meat, but it's his specialty seafood. The food is spot on great. They design the room so there really isn't a bad table. Everybody's ringside to the skating rink, ringside to the tree, and it's just magical. You know, they pipe in music, and you know, so before dinner or after dinner, you wander outside and you'll have this great soundtrack. People that really know how to skate use the skating rink, so it's beautiful. And there's the tree, and if you're lucky, there's real snow. It's magical.
Oh, and right across the street is Saks Fifth Avenue with the beautiful windows.
Yes, yeah. Oh. If you're window shopping up and down the avenues, it's perfect. It's just, it's that, and that, the whole Rock Center complex, to me, is just one of the real architectural jewels of the city. It's a beautiful spot.
Both of these places that you're talking about now tend to be on the pricey side. Any ideas for places that have all the romance but are not necessarily very expensive?
There is, and I'm gonna plug this chap twice because he's a pastry chef. His name's Paillard, Francois Paillard, and he's up on 70 something in Lex. We'll have it on your website. I just know it by radar. It's probably the best full blown patisserie in the city, kind of like what Fauchon was in Paris in its heyday. Mm-hmm. In the front room, you walk in and there's just great coffee, great hot chocolate, you know, made with melted chocolate the real old fashioned way. Superb pastries. He's a huge talent. Resume like you can't imagine. And in the back of this shop, which is where I go for snacks, he's got a really nice casual kind of a bistro setting on two levels, relatively bargain prices, great food. He takes the food as seriously as he does the pastry, but it's not quite on the high mm-hmm, end level, but mm-hmm. The cooking is great. I love it. You know, that's a great, if you're in that neighborhood, which you will be around the holidays, shopping on Madison or wandering around doing the museum thing, it's a perfect spot either for pastries in the front and a great cup of coffee. And again, I think these are pastries that pretty much set the standard for that genre period. And if you're looking for something a little bigger, just go into the back room. And they have great food all year long.
Hey, Mike, Merry Christmas.
Thank you. Jingle bells and sleigh bells and all that stuff. You too. Enjoy.
Thanks. You can see the one and only Mike Colomeco on Mike Colomeco's Food Show on New York's PBS 13. Now, you can find Mike's New York City holiday picks on the website splendidtable.org. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, the trivia question is, what traditional Christmas treat was described in a newspaper article as smelling like a toxic waste product? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we'll be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/Super Target. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what traditional Christmas treat was described in a newspaper article as smelling like a toxic waste product? The answer is lutefisk, a Norwegian tradition at Christmas, at least with the Norwegians of Minnesota and Wisconsin. I've heard that the Norwegians in Norway wised up years ago. They realized they could still have Christmas without suffering through lutefisk. So what is this stuff? Well, lutefisk is dried cod that's soaked in lye. Now, the lye water reconstitutes the fish, and it coaxes out an almost indescribable fragrance. Some have said garbage dump in high summer. Others say mom and apple pie. Now, here's where the newspaper quote comes in. Years ago, I interviewed the president of the area's largest producer. This guy was straight from Central Casting. Looked like Eric the Red, only bigger. His enthusiasm was boundless. I mean, the factory reek did not faze him a bit. Now, he said that lutefisk sales climbed every year, but recently he'd hit a bump. The Minneapolis Star Tribune had described this Christmas treasure of the bedrock of its readers, the Norwegian immigrants and their kin, as smelling like a toxic waste material. And he said this could affect future sales. It's time for your calls, brought to you by the new Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. Okay, pick up that phone, guys. The number is 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's see who is up first. We have got Donna on the line, and she's calling from Princeton, New Jersey. Hey, Donna, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I want to have a party over the holidays.
Uh-huh.
For people that don't know each other very well. You know, one of those parties where you have your acquaintances and some good friends.
Yeah.
But I want everybody to be able to circulate and have something to do. So I'm thinking I might have a soup slurp.
is great.
Thanks.
A soup slurp. I love it.
Yeah, and I'm calling to ask you, what kind of soup should I have? Do I have to have enough of each soup to serve everybody? So if somebody wants some, you know, they...
Well, everybody's going to want to taste every one,
everything.
But they're probably not going to have, you know, big, you'll do this in mugs, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're not, I don't think everybody's going to want to have a big hearty portion, but, so this is going to be a, like a buffet, right?
Yeah.
And have
I,
people wandering
I thought
around.
A couple of crock pots on the dining room table and then something on the stove,
idea. Maybe. And this is all stuff you can do ahead.
Yes.
It could be frozen or, you know, I mean, and anything that's left over you can stick in the freezer.
Right.
All right, here's the deal. I'm just thinking, you know, you put together, I think, three soups the way you do a cheese tray.
Okay.
In the sense that you want contrast. So I would think one that's very light and fresh and vegetable-y. But it might even have an Asian feel to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might be the kind of thing where you do a really interesting vegetable or chicken broth that you have a little bit of fish sauce in it, and you have maybe some fresh ginger and garlic in it or lemongrass. And then at the last minute, you drop in some fine cut, you know, snow pea pods or bok choy or that kind of thing. Maybe even some broken rice noodles, although I think it's bad luck to break noodles. Drop in some rice. We don't want any bad luck on your party. But something that doesn't have any meat in it and really is very light and fresh feeling. So that would be one thing, okay, in the crock pot. And if the vegetables get soft, that's fine. But you still have that nice, bright, lively flavor. Maybe have a squeeze of lime that you do at the last minute over the top of it. And then I think you want something, you want a cream soup.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be a vegetable cream soup or it could be, now where do you live?
I'm in Princeton, New Jersey.
Okay, yeah. Because what I'm thinking, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I have that cookbook with Jasper White's chowder in it. It's pretty good. I know you've had him on the show.
Oh, Jasper, chowder would be fabulous.
That'd be good?
I think that would be wonderful.
I'm torn between that and the Silver Palate lobster bisque.
I would say you flip a coin.
They're both so fabulous.
Yeah, they're both so fabulous. Okay. And I think the chowder's a little less expensive, too.
Yeah, I think so, too. Yeah.
So considering what the price, I wanted to treat myself to a lobster the other day, and I looked at the price, and I said, you know, no, I can't do a bank loan yet. So, but at any rate, you've got the idea.
Okay.
And then I think what you want is a meal in a bowl kind of soup.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do something like a Hungarian goulash soup with sauerkraut so that it's chunks of lean pork that you've browned and you've cooked and cooked with paprika and garlic and a bit of, you know, a bit of red pepper and onion and even chopped up sauerkraut in a broth. It is, I mean, it's the kind
that
of thing.
That sounds wonderful.
It's fabulous. You could also do a New Mexican pozole, you know, chunks, I'm in the pork phase here, but chunks of pork shoulder that are cooked with hominy, you know, dried hominy and green chilies, and they make their own broth. It's that's another soup that you just, it's a little garlic, a little onion, and you just let it cook and cook and cook and cook, and it's wonderful. And there's a trick, my friend Sam Arnold, who had the Fort restaurant in Colorado, had evidently a recipe from the granddaughter of Kit Carson, where fresh avocado went into it and a dab of sour cream, and that was fabulous. You could do a classic Provence bean soup, a pea stew, you know, with beans and, if you wanted to, bits of meat. But, you know, something that is really hearty.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, that's what I would do. So you have fresh light, got creamy, and then you've got the meal in a bowl.
And then round it out with good breads. And
good breads, maybe some hunks of cheese around for those who want to chew rather than slurp. But I think, boy, what an icebreaker, because people will be talking about them and, you know, have you tried this? And you know, you could even, if you're ambitious, you could do some sauces that would go, like, into the soups. Like, if you did a fish soup, you could do a little bit of that Provence roux. You know, it's garlic and soaked bread and olive oil that you whip together with a little hot pepper.
Like, I've never had that, but that sounds wonderful.
It's killer. I mean, it's great on toast. It's great to dip stuff in, but it's also great just plopped in the middle of a soup. Uh-huh. Wouldn't be bad in a cream soup.
Oh, that sounds great.
Or in a chowder, you know? It'd be kind of sexy to have that on the side and just encourage people to dab it in.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds wonderful, Lynn. Thank you so much for your ideas.
Hey, thanks for calling, and it sounds like a great party.
Okay, thanks.
Have a ball. Take
Bye.
Care, Donna. Bye. 800-537-5252. 52. I don't think anything is easier than this kind of party. And I think she's dead on that it's going to get people mixing. And because you don't want to have people who don't know each other very well at a sit-down dinner. I mean, God forbid they don't talk to each other. But when they're milling around, they have to have contact. And also never have quite enough chairs for everybody you invite. 800-537-5252. We have Jenny on the phone from New Ulm, Minnesota. Jenny, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I'm calling because we raised our own turkeys this year, and when we've had one of them, it's been a little flat tasting. So what I'm looking for is maybe a brine to enhance the flavor of them a little bit.
Do you think they may have been unhappy in their childhood or something?
I don't think so. We've been pretty nice to them.
That's got to be so disappointing that you go to all that effort and the thing doesn't really taste fabulous.
Well, you know, it didn't taste bad. I think what it is don't they inject the ones with kind of like a brine solution?
A lot of the stuff that you get in the store has been injected with a ton of salt and flavorings and all that kind
and
of thing.
So the flavor's there. It just needs a little bit more.
Well, brining is the same thing, and you control what goes into it. Okay, the basic formula for brine is that for every 4 quarts of water, you want between a half cup and a full cup of kosher salt. And if kosher salt is very light and flaky, and it's very neutral tasting, if you're using regular salt, you want maybe 1/3 less of that. So you want a third of a cup to 2/3 of a cup for every 4 quarts of water. And then you want something else. Now, it can be brown sugar. Okay. Again, for 4 quarts, no less than a half cup of tight-packed brown sugar. You're not going to taste super sweet. You're going to just get a suggestion of it. And the other thing I love to use, especially with stuff that's tasting a little blah, I use hot chili powder. And if you don't get super heat, and I mean like a half cup of it, you just get a nice taste. Just remember this rule. With a brine, whatever flavor you want to get out of that brine, you have to use a ton of that flavoring. Otherwise, you're not going to get it. So if you want to do garlic, you would use 2 heads or 3 heads of garlic for 4 quarts of water that you would crush and you'd throw in there.
Okay. Is that going to affect the flavor of like any gravies or anything that we would make then if we did the garlic or?
Well, you'd get some of the, you know, because some of the meat juices would have a subtle flavor of that, but that would only make it taste better.
Okay. With the hot chili powder, is that like a cayenne or is that?
No, I wouldn't go so far. That's really hot. I'd do a medium hot one. Something you might find in the supermarket, you might find like even a hot paprika would work. But, but I'm just giving you the idea. If you want to use fresh herbs, you could use fresh or dried herbs as well.
Okay, but a lot of it is.
Yeah.
Okay, and then you do that overnight?
You do that overnight. Yeah.
Okay.
And it should be submerged and should be kept really cold. And there, in fact, someone told me that there are these new bags that I think Williams-Sonoma carries them, but you can use even a heavy roasting bag, something that really is durable that you could actually, if you can't, don't have room in the refrigerator, or, well, you're in Newell, Minnesota, put it in the garage.
I know, that's what I'm thinking.
but otherwise, you know, really have a very heavy plastic bag in the fridge if you have no room for a big pot.
Okay.
You take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye. If you're an online comic strip fan, you probably know about the Feast of the Seven Fishes, the strip story of Robert Tunnell's Italian family preparing for Christmas Eve back in 1983. It's one of those deals, though, that you really don't have to be Italian. I mean, if you've ever had a new girlfriend, a Spitfire grandmother, or a few family characters, you're going to love this tale. Well, Robert's put the strip into a book called, of course, Feast of the Seven Fishes, but with recipes, no less. Robert, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Robert, why not just write the story? Why the comic strip?
Well, I've been very fortunate to sort of back my way into comic book writing. I was a comic book fan. I didn't realize it was going to sort of mutate into a whole other career for me. And subsequently, when the opportunity came to develop a story that I wanted to tell so much, it seemed like a no-brainer because I didn't have to try and go convince someone, hey, we can make this as a movie, which was my original intention.
Right.
We could put the material out there. And the beautiful thing about the comic strip format is I'm not married to, you know, having to work in such a straight line. I could actually stop, as we do in the middle of the strip, and talk about the food and talk about how the food's being prepared, you know, and have, we can have fun with it. And so it actually, you know, it kind of, it achieved a few goals for me.
So who actually does the drawing?
Well, I'm blessed. I had, for the first half of the strip, I had Ed Pisker, who's a very talented young artist from Pittsburgh, who draws American Splendor for Harvey Pekar, which was the movie with Paul Giamatti
right,
last year.
Right.
And then Ed's schedule just got out of control, and I said, well, you know, I couldn't wait. I wanted to finish the storyline. So I brought in my friend Alex Saviak, who draws Spider-Man daily and weekend newspaper strips. I can't believe that worked out for me.
You really did hit it, didn't you?
I really did.
So tell us the story of the Seven Fishes.
I had two goals with this. On the surface, I wanted to tell a romantic comedy. I wanted to have a love story set against the Christmas holidays because I just think it's the most romantic time of the year. And, you know, and as we say in the book, when you're young, you're like 20 years old, there's nothing you want more than a girlfriend or a boyfriend for Christmas, even if you're going to be, you know, breaking up with them by New Year's. I mean, you're
exactly.
Like, by December 28th, I'm like a raccoon in a trap trying to chew his arm off to get out of this. But, you know, on December 23rd, you're like, she's the most beautiful girl in the world. And so I wanted to capture that because I thought it was something. But I think the best stories are ones that are set against a world that is actually grounded in reality and grounded with that sort of detail. And a detail that I knew very well and absolutely loved was my family's celebration of the feast. And I thought, you know, at the same time with telling this story, I can capture and preserve these traditions that my family carries out.
Tell me a little bit about those traditions. Your grandmother seems to be just one of the great people of all time.
She was amazing, you know. She so affected my storytelling sensibility. You know, for example, she, when I was a kid, I was really into horror movies, and I said to her, I was always trying to look for the true vampire, the true ghost, and I would say, like, you know, well, oh, did they have vampires in Italy? She said, oh, yes, but, you know, we don't have them in the United States because, you know, all the telephone poles are shaped like crosses. You know? She was just incredible. And you know, these were poor peasant people. She could make do with anything. My great-grandfather died not in the mines, but because of the mines in the early 40s, and so she was widowed relatively, you know, and she was probably 50 at the time, and she scraped. I mean, she really, you know, there was no one there to help out, and she was the kind of person that, you know, like I went squirrel hunting once, and I shot a squirrel, and she's like, hey, give it to me, and she made, you know, red sauce with it. It was incredible.
Tell us about the seven fishes. What are they, and how does that all work?
Well, you know, every family, I think, has a variation on it, and every village most likely has a variation on it. In the north central West Virginia, Pittsburgh area, we do smelt, the little fish, whiting, bacala, which is the salt cod. We'll do several variations of calamari. We'll do eel. Some families will do like an anchovy pasta. It's really limitless. Oysters, shrimp, as long as it's seafood. You know, we don't stick to seven anymore. I mean, we're classic overachievers.
You know, you're out there.
We brought an octopus in last year, and it was just marvelous.
So it's still going on.
Absolutely.
And this is Christmas Eve for your family.
It is. It is. I was fortunate enough to speak at the Cercolo de' Medici and the Italian Heritage Society in Detroit a short time ago, and they're very, very passionate about honoring their past. And it struck me when I was speaking to the group, I said, you know, we spend so much money to build these tombstones and monuments to our dead grandparents, you know, and trying to do the right thing and put them in a graveyard that nobody goes and visits. How about a living monument by teaching these recipes and phrases and feet, you know, just the really keeping it alive. I mean, what better monument could you have than that?
Absolutely. Hey, Robert, thank you, and a very happy Feast of the Seven Fishes.
Thank you so much, Lynn. Merry Christmas.
Robert Tunnell is author of Feast of the Seven Fishes, the collected comic strip, and Italian Holiday Cookbook. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. 800-537-5252. And while we're thinking about seafood, let me leave you with this quote from Roy Blunt Jr. He said, "I prefer my oysters fried. That way I know my oysters died." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. Now, while you're there, be sure to sign up for our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. Register for it online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by the new Muir Glen Organic Soup Collection. Gourmet recipe soups made from premium garden fresh ingredients. You can learn more at muirglen.com. Muir Glen Organic Soups, created to savor. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell and Janelle Sorensen. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham, Julia Schrenkler, and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.